Welcome to another episode of my wake-up call. And my guest doesn't know this, but you, my listeners, know this. I am over the moon excited about my guest. And he's already feeling performance anxiety with that. So let me tell you why. And let me tell you a little bit about Soren Kaplan, Dr. Soren Kaplan. He's an award-winning author, and he has a recent book called Experiential Intelligence: Harness the Power of Experience for Personal and Business Breakthroughs. He's an affiliate at the Center for Effective Organizations at the University of Southern California. He's a former corporate executive, founder of three Silicon Valley startups, and a columnist for Inc. magazine. He's an international keynote speaker. He's led professional development programs for thousands of executives around the world, including Disney, NBC Universal, Visa, PayPal, Colgate-Palmolive, geez, are they still around? Kimberly-Clark, Medtronic, Bill George, I had him on, Roche, Hershey's, and Red Bull, and many others. And my listeners already know why I'm excited. And I got to speak to Soren a little bit before this about experiential intelligence. So Soren, I'm going to begin the way I always begin, because I'm getting close to the time when I need to shut up and just listen. So if I ask you, what is the through line in you? What is most important to you, you know, beyond particular achievements, beyond family and friends? But if I were to ask you kind of what your purpose and calling is, tell us what that, here's the first thing, tell us what it is. Give us an origin story or two, because I'm a shrink, I'm a little bit of a voyeur, as are my listeners. We want to know how you started out. And then tell us about your journey and finally ending up into what's most important to you. And we'll land in experiential intelligence. And the floor is yours until I interrupt you.
Thank you, Mark. Pleasure to be here. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. And early on, when I was 3 years old, my mother, she developed a pretty significant mental illness. We had moved to California so that we could be part of a spiritual community that my parents gravitated to after dropping out of Harvard, studying world religion and philosophy. And we lived on Ram Dass's ranch for a little while, Richard Alpert. And my parents discovered a community in the San Francisco Bay Area where we grew up. My mother developed mental illness. My father was rarely around. And by the time I was 15 years old, we had moved 16 times around the country and landed in California. My through line, I experienced a lot of, some, probably you could call it trauma growing up. And I, you know, as I grew older and I went into business and I did a bunch of things that you could call successful, I don't believe I truly understood myself and what was making me tick and what was driving me. And I was on autopilot and didn't know it, even though by certain measures, I looked like I had things going for me. So over time, I had a number of other experiences that really challenged the fact that I didn't have everything going for me. And I came to the recognition that after even working with a lot of big name brand companies and traveling the world and leading executive education programs, that I was living a life that was a little illusionary in terms of what I thought I was doing and really what was happening. And as I realized that, I recognized that I needed to heal from some of my traumas. And I did a lot of work on myself. And that included, you know, kind of formal work like EMDR, eye movement desensitization response, meditation, being just vulnerable and empathetic with others and myself. But what I realized is that the experiences that really I had to overcome had instilled certain self-limiting beliefs and certain ways in which I was limiting my relationships and limiting my potential. And that as I was able to get through some of that, I also realized at the same time, those same experiences instilled certain mindsets and certain abilities that actually I could leverage and lean into to amplify further. So as I was kind of healing, I was also growing because I was leveraging the same things I was overcoming, but the flip side of the coin, so to speak. So I had to grow up with very little structure and a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty, and I had to make decisions with very little data. Well, if you look at the things that are needed to drive innovation, change organizational culture, live with uncertainty in, you know, various work processes tied to startups, those are the things that I realized I had sort of been doing semi-consciously, but that I could help others learn about because of my own experience and provide to the world. And so experiential intelligence for me in writing this book is about my very vulnerable storyline and talking about how I evolved my own thinking and have kind of understood my own process to turn it into something that hopefully is intuitive and practical and strategic for other people, because my purpose, as you asked, is to try to give people tools and resources to help them understand themselves so that they can help others in some meaningful way and amplify their own contribution to the world. And I want to do that in a scalable way. So that's the essence of my first answer to your first question.
You have no idea, Soren, how much my listeners and I just fell in love with you. You really don't. You said something I want to give you a little that I'd never connected, and I hope you'll do something with it. Leveraging healing for growth. If there was a way to narrow the gap between that, so that when someone is healing and vulnerable and they feel like they're going to go crazy, if there would be a way that you could make them also experience how they're growing, so they'd be willing to take a chance on doing what's necessary to heal, there's something in that. I don't know, but the way you said it, that because a lot of times healing feels like I got to break apart, a psychedelic's got to rip me apart because I'm all screwed up and I'm not really wired well. And then I got to go break apart, fall apart, and have someone reassure me that I'm going to come back together again. And then I'll integrate it, then I'll grow. But the way you said it, I mean, I hope you write down a note, healing and growth, because I think what might give people who need to heal the courage to do it is if you can somehow not convince them, but get them to see how it's going to cause them to grow in ways that doing anything else won't. So I just want to reflect that back to you because it just hit me like a ton of bricks.
I appreciate that reflection. I think that the world we live in, especially our society, has a fix-it medical model to a lot of this. And that we, see something that's broken and we sort of pathologize it. That's why there's been a little bit of a pathology around, some of our mental illness challenges we've had. And I think that's going away a little bit and moving, in a different direction. But we want to fix it. And I think that if I just look at my own experience, I did a lot of work on myself with some very well-known professionals who were looking to fix something that I was presenting as a problem, but never once did we, the example in my book is actually EMDR. And I use that as a technique to kind of rewire my nervous system as it's associated with some of my past experiences. And we fixed it. I mean, to a certain extent, I think it really helped. But never once, and it's no fault of the person I was working with or the model, but never once did we say, that same experience that we had to address, what strengths what did it give you as a person that has allowed you to cope and to apply what you gained from it, or that you could apply what you gained from it to do whatever you want to do next? And it was about fixing versus growing. And I just look at those two things as complementary and kind of two sides of the same coin, at least from my experience and what I've seen with a lot of others. And I think the opportunity, and we've seen a little bit of a trend in positive psychology towards this angle, so that we're looking for assets and strengths rather than deficits and gaps. And so I appreciate you pulling that out of my introduction, because it's really fundamental to how I see the world and what I believe experiential intelligence is all about.
Are you open to my opening you up a little bit?
Please, let's do it.
I'm getting a message from younger Soren, and he's screaming at me for you to find him. He's saying, all that trauma hurt me, and I've been waiting for my adult self to come back, find me, and tell me I'm going to make it. And I'm still waiting. And, you know, can you tell my adult self, I'm glad you sought all that treatment. I'm glad you sought all those things. But I'm still waiting for you to come back and find me and look me in the eye when I'm most paranoid, most scared, most not knowing what's happening with me, and look me in the eye and tell me that we made it. And it's just coming in so loud and clear. I remember I was seeing a very depressed and suicidal young woman, and she said, and this was her metaphor, she said, I'm stuck in a cave. I'm running out of oxygen. I hear people drilling to find me. They're excited because they thought they got a glimpse of me, but they're in the wrong cave. It's a doll. It's not me. And they're excited because they think that doll is me, and it's not. And I can't get them to stop drilling and drill in my cave, and I'm running out of oxygen. So was it okay that I reflected that back to you?
I deeply appreciate it. And I want to tell my younger child self, I did make it through the toughest times. And there's one more piece also, is that it will be okay. Mm. And I think that that's an important, for me, it's an important thing to acknowledge, because in my youth, I didn't always know it was going to be okay. I had a lot of uncertainty and fear about what was around the corner. And eventually it was okay. But I've had to address a lot of that unknowing and kind of that visceral wiring. I call it my visceral memory, so that I know it's also okay. And if I can, you know, intellectually understand it, but if I can also viscerally and kind of through meditation and other relaxation techniques get there, it's really helpful. But not only did I make it through, it'll be okay. And I appreciate your reflection there.
Yeah. Can I add another message that you might give to your younger Soren?
Please.
Not only, little Soren, will it be okay? Everything you're going through, which hurts like hell, is going to enable you to reach people who are feeling this that nobody else can reach. And I'm sorry you're going through this pain, because you're just trying to make it through and you don't know if you're going to make it through. But all this pain and suffering is not for nothing. It's going to give you access into a part of how human beings are that you wouldn't be able to access by something intellectual, by something, you know, purely programmatic, something devoid of experience. And all this pain that you're going through is not for nothing. It's going to teach you things that nothing else could teach you. And I'm sorry you have to go through all this, which you will survive, to learn what it's going to teach you. And you're going to, from someone who doesn't know if he's going to make it through your childhood, you're going to not only make it through your childhood, you're going to be able to reach people and help them make it through their childhood.
I appreciate that. And that ties to what I'm, you know, what I feel is my purpose. And you also touched on, you didn't say the word, but my childhood was very lonely. I felt very alone in the world. And I could list off a lot of different experiences that reinforce that, from being, you know, left at places and not knowing if I was having rides and having to walk home 4 or 5 miles from places and having a lot of uncertainty and just feeling a lot of loneliness. And part of what I think is important also that you said is to, you know, I have done my best to tap into the feelings and the emotions that I had growing up to understand them as an adult in the context of intellectually knowing that I've made it through and that it'll be okay, but also feeling those feelings. I still can feel loneliness. And by making the kind of contributions I want to make, I can, I believe, and I feel it, that it creates greater connection with other people. And it helps to address that feeling of loneliness. It's my healing to make those contributions and to kind of, you know, provide what I can to other people. So as they go through their own experiences, whether it's loneliness or fear or whatever those other things are, that they can get through it, and not just get through it, but recognize that they can then do something with it for themselves as healing and growth, and to help others and create that greater connection with other people, because those vulnerable connections are just healing. And I think that that's a really an important thing that you pulled out around that, making a contribution like that. And that's what I'm hoping to do.
So I'm going to share a story. I'm up to about 475 recorded episodes, and most of my listeners have heard my stories over and over again. This is one I've never shared in 475 episodes, and I'm going to share a story, and I'm hoping you'll, you know, ante up and share a story. It's a little bit embarrassing, but you teed it up well. I think I was in the second or third grade, my elementary school. Felt disconnected from everybody. And it was a Friday afternoon. And we had a gym. And there was a locker room in the gym. And I'm not sure why I did this, but I went into the locker room on a Friday afternoon. And I wanted to see if I could fit into a locker. And they had full-size lockers. I must have been, maybe it was first grade, I don't know. But I fit myself in the locker. And I closed the door and I couldn't get out. I didn't want to scream because I was so embarrassed. Oh my God, I've done something wrong. And I think part of what it was, this is overly symbolic, I think I wanted to go back into the womb. I mean, I wanted to go back in the womb and just, you know, it's almost like I was born half-baked and I wanted to get fully baked. And that locker looked like a womb. So I go into it, I close the door, I'm in the womb, and then I can't get out. And I hear the buses coming and picking up the first level of kids. I still haven't said anything because I'm really embarrassed. And then I hear the second bus come and pick up kids. And then I realize there's no more buses. It's Friday afternoon. And I start wailing. I start screaming. And I don't know how long I'm screaming for, you know, but finally, I guess a janitor comes in, opens the locker, and I couldn't look at him. And I said, someone pushed me in the locker. I couldn't own up to it. I don't know who it was. I didn't see them. Someone pushed me in the locker. And, I guess they called my family. They picked me up. And then I remember we had my parents and I and the principal had to meet Monday. And I think I still stuck with the story. Someone pushed me into the locker. And I don't think I've shared that story in 470 plus episodes. But you're making it safe for me to share it. And maybe, doctor, heal thyself. You know, Mark, you're pushing Soren to go back to his little Soren. Maybe little Mark in the locker is waiting for you to open it up and say, Mark, what the heck you doing there? Well, but no, it's okay. I know you got in there. What the heck you doing there? And he wouldn't have words, but maybe he would have said, I just feel alone and I want to wrap something around me that tells me it'll be okay. And I picked the wrong thing to wrap around me.
Well, vulnerability breeds vulnerability. And so if I were physically there, I'd give you a hug right now, Mark, but I'll share my own story with you and I'll draw a line of sight to it also in terms of how it impacted me following the story as well. So I was probably in first grade, maybe 7 years old. My father was out. It was probably about 9 p.m. And my sister is 3.5 years younger than I am. So she is, 3.5, 4 years old. And my mother comes in to our bedroom. We had bunk beds. And she said, we have to leave. They're coming to get us. We have to leave now, with a lot of intense energy. And we were in our pajamas, and I think we just got up and we got into our 1973 Datsun B210 car, and it was dead night and dark, and she was driving, and we didn't know where we were going, and we headed off. This was in the East Bay in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we made it to another town, and she drove into this neighborhood. She got us out of the car, and we were in kind of like a kind of middle class neighborhood. I think there were little duplexes, and there were these shrubs that were in between the duplexes. Instead of a fence, it was a shrub. And she shuttled me and my sister into this shrub that had been kind of cut out. I think the utility company had cut out a little area of the shrub. And we hunkered down for about 20 minutes. So we sat there for 20 minutes, not knowing what was going on. I didn't know who was coming to get us. That's all the information I had. And then I saw some headlights pull up under the street and kind of light up our hedge. And my father got out of the car. He had gotten home and sort of intuited where we would be. And we were at the home of my mother's therapist. Somehow she knew where he lived. And he was also part of the spiritual community that we were part of. And my father found us, and the gentleman whose house it was, he came out. And I just remember the embarrassment that I had about what was going on without really even understanding what was going on. I had fear. I had embarrassment. I was observing my father irritated and my mother confused and this other guy surprised. And it was a very confusing moment. But it was also the moment in which I recognized that not everything my mother would say to me, I could believe. And not everything that I thought was reality might be reality. And it was really a turning point in my young adulthood, not even adulthood. I was 7 years old in my childhood. That was sort of this wake-up call. And as I trace that forward, I grew up in a fringe spiritual community in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was embarrassed by that, you know, going to public high school. I was embarrassed by my mother for many years when she was still living with us, from her behavior and some of the things she would say if I had friends over. And so I developed a fear of judgment from other people. I really closed off in terms of trying to look very polished in everything I did, which took a lot of work and effort and was very difficult to do. And even some of my closest friends, even after I had graduated college, never knew about my mother and her mental illness. And so I did a lot of things that protected my image, that made me look really good in kind of society's eyes, and went to some good schools. And I tried to portray myself as really put together, when in actuality, I was lonely. I was fearful. I was fearful of judgment. And those things were driving me, and I wasn't aware of it. But, you know, that turning point moment, just like your locker story, is a story that has sat with me for a long time. And I needed to understand it in order to understand myself better, and then look at what I needed to heal from. But then also, what that's one example of the incredible uncertainty I had to live with, which has also given me skills and abilities like reading people's emotions and facial expressions and seeing patterns in very complex, ambiguous situations, and being able to facilitate groups and read the room. And so, again, it's healing and growth all at the same time. And how do I now take that experience and lean into it and help use those skills that I have, these abilities, the mindsets, which is experiential intelligence, to continue moving forward, because it'll be okay. And I made it through it. But those are, you know, that's my story. That's my response to your great question.
So I sometimes talk to the third wall, which are the listeners. If you've listened to this episode so far, and we're not done, we have time, and you know leaders who are really good leaders, but they need to fix something from their inside out. And you get a sense that they're ill at ease. You know, and if they're leaders, they're probably not tentative. They're probably the opposite. They can come off as a little bit dogmatic, a little bit opinionated, a little bit, you know, whatever, because they're guarding something. And if you know leaders like that, you need to connect them with Soren. You need to connect them with his book. Because if you're a leader and you're not solid from the inside out, sooner or later, your people will catch on to it. And they're going to feel ill at ease, because, not to say that you're a leader with mental illness, but if you're not really solid from the inside out, it could come back to bite you. So if you're listening to this and you are a CEO, or you know of a CEO, I'm telling you, you need to connect them with Soren. Do you know Chip Conley? So I often refer to the podcast when he was on, and he talked about having achiever's disease. He was addicted to achievement, and he reached a point where 5 of his friends died by suicide. He was depressed and suicidal. He had all the money that he needed. He went from joie de vivre hotels to B&B, but it wasn't protecting him from this. So he pivoted to the Modern Elder Academy, which, if you haven't been part of, you know, I'll make the introduction. You need to connect with each other. But when we talked, when he was on the podcast, and he's still addicted to achievement, you know, don't throw away that coping mechanism. Yeah, it'd be great to heal, but don't throw away totally your coping mechanism. And I suggested to him, that he might have something called the syndrome of disavowed yearning. And he said, what's that? I said, deep inside you is the yearning to feel whole and safe. And it wasn't to be had for whatever reason. And then you happened upon achievement. And boy, that was pretty good. You got a little dopamine, you got a little adrenaline, you got a little momentum, you got a little money. It's pretty good. And it feels like it's going to fix everything. But over time, you realize you're putting lipstick on a pain. And what happened is you convinced yourself you didn't need that connection because it wasn't to be had. And you happened upon achievement, you know, which you can do for 40, 50 years until you can't. So I'm just sharing that with you if any of that resonates with you.
A lot of it resonates with me. The disavowed yearning and feeling safe. You know, the other story, another story, it's in my book, and I'll share it now in more detail. I grew up in the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area, a town called Walnut Creek, and I went to high school in a town called Lafayette, which is kind of pretty affluent. And the East Bay is sort of close to Lake Tahoe, which is the mountains, and a lot of my peers in high school were going skiing a lot. I would ask my father if he would take me skiing. He had grown up skiing and I wanted to kind of learn to ski. And he basically would never commit to take me skiing. And the reason why was because he was part of a spiritual community in Walnut Creek. And the leader of that community would include him in various events. And sometimes he might get invited to lunch or dinner on the weekends, and he wanted to keep his calendar free without any commitments so that in case he was invited by his spiritual guru, that he could say yes. And so he was very explicit with me about it. He said, this is more important than skiing, and I'm going to keep my calendar. So what I learned also is that many decisions in that community were only made if the leader of that community would basically give permission or say it's a good idea. So I wrote a letter to the leader of this community, mailed it, and said, my father's not taking me. Will you please tell him to take me skiing? So within a week, my father had scheduled for the next weekend to take me skiing. So I got what I was looking for on the one hand. But my father was really only taking me skiing because he was told to do so. And as much as I enjoyed going up to the slopes, I also felt, I still felt like I wasn't worthy of my father's attention. And so that lack of feeling worthiness, that I'm not worthy of attention, led me to the disavowed yearning of acknowledgement for my contributions and as a person. So my own drive for achievement and doing things in a way that looked very polished so that people couldn't judge me and I'd get all the kind of accolades of doing things right ties back to this feeling of not being worthy and wanting to find that worthiness through achievement. And so I connect to that disavowed yearning and the achievement theme quite strongly. And it's something that I've had to understand for myself. And also, achievement isn't a bad thing in and of itself. And I've looked at, you know, the skill sets that have allowed me to achieve, I want to leverage, but the underlying drivers of what I'm doing, I wanted to heal from. And by doing that, I found more balance.
Wow. I'm glad we have time, Soren, because you're triggering something. So I'm willing to go if you're willing to go. This is a long form interview. I felt very similar things that, you know, my father was, we were in a spiritual community, but you know, he wasn't he wasn't the boss of his company. He worked for a boss. And what I realized is that there was a part of him that was afraid of displeasing the boss. And so he might do something like pick up the boss's kids and leave us out in the rain. That could be hurtful and fearful. But, you know, I understand that because if he has a fear, can I provide for the family? Got to take care of the boss. And so there was a part of me that felt unworthy. But I'll tell you something I've discovered recently, and maybe this will introduce a part of your Jungian shadow to you. What I realized that underneath the hurt of feeling unworthy was anger and rage. And of course, I couldn't demonstrate anger or rage because if I felt unworthy doing the best I could, boy, if I showed anger or rage, I'd be in for I don't know what. And here's one of the ways I acted out. Haven't shared this story. I'm sure my listeners will say, hey, Mark, this is good. You're getting new stories out here. So my father was a pretty good athlete growing up. And when he got older, he shifted to golf. And he was a pretty good golfer. And so I started playing golf. Oh, maybe I'll get a way to get close to my dad. And I got really good at golf. I mean, I got to be a 3 handicap with metal shafts, and I was slight, and I could hit the ball 250 yards before graphite and before these big things. And so I got to be much better than my dad. And there were times when he would include me in the foursome. And other people would say, geez, your kid's good. And my dad would say, he can do better, you know. And I mean, this is how it can screw up your mind. So, and I think this is before I got down to a 3 handicap. That required me to sort of, you know, go to college, play at Tilden Park behind Berkeley, you know, near Orinda and all that. And so I know Walnut Creek. And I remember as soon as my father would say, hey, you're having a good round, this would be going into the 16th, 17th hole. And I wanted to have a good round. But as soon as he said that in front of other people, I started hitting the ball dead right, dead left, into the woods, you know, and I would get, you know, I'd be close to par. And the last 2 or 3 holes, I'd shoot 7, 8. I think there must have been close to 50 rounds where, you know, I'd shoot 81, 82 because out of that anger, I wanted to embarrass him. It's almost like I was saying, gee, thanks, Dad. Where were you on the 3rd hole when I was in the sand trap? but I'm sharing that with you and our listeners because something that I've realized that has set me free is that all of us have a Jungian shadow. And my interpretation of that is we all have parts of our personality that we're ashamed of. And usually it's tied to, we didn't just feel hurt and afraid when we were young. We felt angry and enraged, but we were fearful of showing it. So we had to suck it down. But it stays there. And what I've discovered as an adult and as a therapist is everybody has these dark sides to their personality. And as long as you don't act on them, you're good to go. The key is be aware of them. Be aware of them. Here's a shameful thing. I love my children, but I hated the responsibility of being a father because I felt sooner or later I'm going to disappoint them because I'm far from perfect. And then if my children see me as some big disappointment, what's that going to feel like? And I knew it was inevitable because I knew I was flawed. And so there was a part of me that loved my children but resented them because sooner or later, this was going to happen. It was inevitable. And plus, when kids become teenagers, they don't need help expressing their disappointment, their upset. They can do it better. So I'm just sharing this because See what Sauron has brought out of me? I don't have these conversations. I've had 470. I don't have these conversations. So as you're listening in, Sauron can have this exchange with you.
I appreciate you sharing these stories. The shadow self that you shared, it really illustrates another principle that I've personally learned because I've done it, which is we tend to manifest our biggest fears.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so fearful. I mean, in your story, you were fearful of something happening. So you compensated and sort of created the thing that you were not wanting to have happen. And I've done the same in my life. I adopted a very judgmental mindset because of if I were to judge other people, it would protect me from their judgment, so to speak. And I've always, worried about others judging me, yet I have brought that to my own relationships and caused issues because of that. And I think that we need to shine a light, if we can, on those shadows to understand them and be self-aware of them. And that's the healing part of that. And then the experiences, again, that helped create those shadows, if we can look at them as what did they give to us at the same time, we can not just shine a light on some of those experiences and how they impacted us negatively so that we're aware of them, but also how do we use those things that might have once seemed quite painful and look at them in another way.
You've done it again, Sauron. So I got to tell you, you talked about being judgmental in some of your relationships. One of my ways of coping is I was very sarcastic and cynical. In fact, when I saw vulnerability, I wouldn't really put you down, but I could say something really cutting and funny. And I remember I was really intimidated by my internship. It was a little scary for me, scared of making a mistake. And I coped with it by being very sarcastic. And here I am going to go into psychiatry. So about 5 years later, I finished my internship. I finished my psychiatry residency. And I run into someone from my internship. And we talk. And he said to me, "Are you seeing a therapist?" I said, "Yeah, why?" He said, "We've just talked for 10 minutes. And you have not said one sarcastic thing." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "When we were interns together, you were one of the funniest, most sarcastic, most cynical people, and people with, you could make anyone laugh, but I would never share anything, that I felt vulnerable about." And he said, and I said, "Oh, this is great. Oh, great. Thank you. You wouldn't dare open up to me, and I'm a freaking psychiatrist." Oh, this is, he said, No. "I'm bringing it up because you're not that person anymore. And if you're seeing a therapist, I got some of the same problems. Can you give me his name?" So I referred him to this therapist. But, you're tracking with that kind of dynamic?
Oh, I 100% tracking on multiple levels. As we do work, from my own EMDR and therapy and meditation and men's groups, as we unwind some of those, the things that stifle us or that kind of become scars on our self, as we unwind those things, we open up to new ways of being in the world with ourselves, especially, and then with other people. And I think that is a reflection that we grow and we change based on our own development path. So that's one element of, where I resonate. The other is the notion that I was very closed and protective of my own story and my feelings. And what I have found over time is that my relationships, because of that, were at a certain surface level. And as I would get in touch with what was important to me, which was vulnerability and openness and talking about struggles and challenges and joyous moments and feelings, that if I were to take the lead and role model, not even role model, just take the lead and do it, I'd get it in return. And if I got it in return, it would deepen the relationship because we would both be open and we would create a level of depth in our connection, in our relationship that would stay there. And then the next time we'd get back, we had a new foundation and we could continue to deepen it. And I think that that vulnerability is sort of a secret sauce for both healing and finding yourself and understanding your assets in a way that by connecting with other people who can reflect to you, like you've been doing today, we can see ourselves differently. And as we see ourselves differently, then we can change our thoughts and shift our feelings and shift our behavior towards things that better serve us and better serve other people.
Well, I could talk with you for hours. If you're listening in and you're a leader, well, if you've listened this far, then, you know, thank you. But if you're a leader who's still skeptical about this vulnerability stuff, why be vulnerable? You got to be strong. What I think Sorn is describing, and I think why it works, is that when you're vulnerable, meaning when you lower your guard, to be honest, the people around you lower their guard. And what you don't realize, although if you look at yourself, you might, it is exhausting to live a life where your guard is always up. It's exhausting because, oh, I'm never going to get hurt, so I'm never going to trust. But it's exhausting. And so one of the benefits, the secret sauce of vulnerability is, and it can't be feigned vulnerability. I know some people who give keynotes and they tell a vulnerable story because it works. And they'll even tear up when they're saying it, but they're saying it with the purpose of convincing the audience, oh, look how open he is. Look how open she is. And I think that's okay if your intent is to be open so that they can open up. But if your intent is, I'm going to open up because I know it really works the audience and they're going to buy product, shame on you. But we're forgiving, so I would say shame on you and then we'll forgive you. It's okay. It's just your Jungian shadow. We all got it. Anyway, how can people find out more about you, your book, and reach out?
My website is my full name, SorenKaplan.com, SorenKaplan.com. On my website, you can get the first chapter of the book. You just can download it. And then there's also a toolkit that includes a lot of the kind of practical tools and templates that we've been actually talking about today. And so that's, you know, from my website, there's all the social media links and so forth.
So if you're listening in, I'm going to give you a challenge, and the antidote is Soren Kaplan. And the challenge is, are you for real? Because if you'd like to be more real, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better guide than Soren. So thank you, Soren. Thank you for listening in to our listeners. Thank you if you've listened through this whole episode. I hope you were as inspired as I was. And take good care of yourself. And when wake-up calls come your way, wake up. And if you need help with that, reach out to someone who cares about you. And reach out and just say, I'd like your help, instead of being cynical and pushing them away. So till next time, everybody, take care.